Well, you have responsibilities in all these positions. And so I've seen the hiring business from the departmental side, and I've seen a lot of it now from the associate dean side. So when you go through, when you get to the part about getting shortlisted at an institution, one of the things you do is you go visit a bunch of people who have nothing to do with the department. And one of those people will typically be somebody who's responsible for making sure that you're not a psychopath and possibly a good graduate supervisor and good graduate instructor. And so that would typically be me at McMaster if you're in science. I have seen a lot of people come through now. I've done something like 150 faculty interviews over time. I've seen the best and the worst. Of course, most people tend to be quite good, but I also see the ways in which people can improve what they do. And I see the ways in which they don't understand the importance of various stages of trying to get a faculty position. So with this talk, and I'd like to make it as interactive as you'd like to make it, I'd like to take you through the various stages, point out things that are perhaps more important than you originally suspected, and help, I hope, to give you guidance on landing a faculty position, if that's the sort of position you're looking for. So, and I want to say, apparently, this worked very well, because practically 2 days after Matt was at this talk last year, he got hired, so. It's going to be a very short talk. There we go. Okay, so there are actually a large number of components of being a competitive hire, a competitive faculty candidate. And I want to, this is sort of a sketch of the various components I'm going to talk about. You need to have some degree of self-awareness, of course, about what your match is, what your prospects are with the place that you're applying to. So you need to understand your actual competitiveness. That also means you need to understand your strengths relative to other people. A constant theme in this whole business is you're, as you go higher and higher into postdoctum and academia, you are competing against more and more savvy and successful people. So the little differences may end up being the big differences. Somebody needs to choose one person, and there are three or four or five being considered. So it's the differences that get amplified. And make sure that you have as many of those differences working for you as possible. So your application and letter and CV, these help get you in the door. They're what show up at the department level. And they are the things that usually there's a search committee within a department that go over the 100 applications and select down 3 to 5 of them to be interviewed. Another component, one that people don't generally, in my experience, give enough thought to, is your choice of letter writers. These are very, very, very critical people, and what they say is very critical. You also have to have a research statement and a teaching statement at most institutions. And once you've got those, you've put them in, they go in ahead of time, they get you on the short list. Once you're on the short list, you visit the institution, and you need to prepare for that, you need to do your interviews, and you need to do your job talk about what your research is. So let's go through some of these things. So first off, there are a lot of people competing for faculty jobs. You know this already. It's always been true. It's still true. And it is just something you're just going to have to be able to manage, put on blinders that just prevent you from being overcome by the magnitude of your task and to move forward as best you can. Small differences I already mentioned. You'd need to have obviously made an impact on the people around you, your supervisor, hopefully your field nationally and internationally. But that's what gets you in the door. What gets you the job is also the other things you do. And that's where these details are so important. One thing that you may not know, and I can say a lot of this from what little I remember of my own experience, is that you have a very different perspective when you're job seeking about why they might be interested in you and why they might be hiring you. They have their own agenda, and different places have different agendas. And learning what the agenda of the place you're looking to be hired is very important. So that's something that some of the other applicants are not going to do well, some of the other shortlist people. So, and their agenda only partially overlaps with yours. So, the things can ch one thing that you should know is there's no destiny in terms of getting on the shortlist and getting the job. I have seen so many times everything completely turned around by what my expectations would have been for the person as they were presented on paper relative to how they interviewed and how they impressed people during the visit. So the game is on. You do stand a chance. You do stand a chance of coming out successfully if you get on that shortlist. And you have a lot of power over that, a surprising amount. It is good to be in the right place at the right time. There are a lot of talented people who don't get jobs because they're not in the right place at the right time, or they don't get academic jobs. And remember, you're always fighting the exponential, which is if your supervisor had 10 graduate students, well, they only need to replace themselves once. So if everybody's doing that, you can tell pretty easily what the overproduction rate is for academic jobs. There is not a large number of vacant jobs waiting in the wings, willing to swoop in. When I was just a junior faculty member, I got put on one of these long-range planning committee panels, and I was responsible for demographics. As an astronomer, an aspiring astronomer, I had been told by all these faculty members that, oh yeah, there are all these people that are going to retire and need to be replaced in the 1990s. So I did the numbers, and there were zero people who are going to retire during the 1990s. They didn't know. They were wrong. Nobody started retiring at all until the 2000s. And so it's easy to get bad information from people who've been in the system a long time. Hopefully not me. Okay, so what are the universities looking for as a general rule? Not field specific. They want you to be an excellent researcher. They want you to be a competitive researcher. They want you to go in and be able to attract graduate students, to be able to attract undergraduate students into doing research. And of course, they want you to be able to do new research. So that's one of the things that gets you tenure, is not doing the same thing you did before. And so you really have to emphasize that break with what you've done before in your research statement. You need to convince them that you're full of new ideas. You know, you're fully developed as a scientist or a scholar, and that you just bursting out of the gate. You don't have you don't want anything to hold you back, and you want them to help you get the funding you need to see all these new ideas explored. One of the things I don't see very much of in the unsuccessful applicants is vision. What do I mean by that? I mean that I think there is a sort of a conceit once you're at the top of your game, once you're a successful postdoc, you have 10 or 15 or 20 papers, that, you know, just hire me, I'm good. I can do this stuff. But universities want to see that you have an idea of the future, you have an idea of how you're going to change their program, you have an idea of how you're going to take whatever they do now and make it better than the competing institution. So they want to see that you have a full-fledged set of ideas for the near term, far term, how you're going to weave yourself into the local tapestry of the science. And that's going to make you competitive in their mind. They want to know that they're not only hiring somebody who's good, but somebody who knows where they want to go and knows that they can get there from here. So to do that, partly need to understand the system. You need to understand that every university, every program is not identical. That there are research-intensive universities, there are teaching-intensive universities, there are universities which play up, that maybe don't have the critical mass themselves, but they get involved with institutions like Perimeter, and they bring critical mass to some area of interest. The system itself is also full of people and rules and history. And so you really need to, whenever you get on a short list, you need to do a lot of homework to find out about this particular institution. Is it all junior faculty members? Is it all people about to retire? What are the degrees of freedom on your on the things that you could do in this institution? The universities want to know that you can supervise graduate students. There are two different basic models of how they determine this. One is you become a faculty member, and then you later qualify to supervise PhD students. Model we have at McMaster is that's part of the interview. You're supposed to not only be able to show you've got the papers and the letters of reference, but you can show that you have the ability to supervise students and to do, if you need to answer questions that are asked of you at the right level for the people asking them. I've already sort of talked about leadership, where you can take them. It is a sad fact, although probably at the end of the day, one in which it works out best, that they want everyone to be leaders. all chiefs, no Indians. So when they're hiring people, they want to hire potential leaders for a research group, a department, whatever. You don't have to necessarily be the leader in all those things immediately. They want to know that they're hiring somebody that can spread out in all directions and be useful to the university in different ways. This thing, impedance match with the institution. There are, for instance, let me give you an example that's not Perimeter related, but at Mac we have a med school. And so if you're being hired in biochemistry, biomedical engineering, biology, chemical biology, if you come into the interview and you don't say something about one of the reasons I want to be at this institution is because of the possibilities of interacting with the folks at the med school, then that shows me that you don't have a big enough perspective on, or if somebody has that and you don't say it, then I'm more inclined to think positively about the other person, because they've They've taken the time to understand the possibilities. So if you are able to say the proximity to the Fields Institute, if you say there's a really good cluster of people in the nearby universities in this area that I think we could really take advantage of, we could start joint graduate programs or have joint graduate classes, that shows that you're thinking outside sort of the box of what you want to accomplish in your research. Okay, so are there any questions so far? Feel free to ask questions. I enjoy most questions. Okay, so yeah.
So one of the things that I consider this year is whether or not it makes more sense to have letter writers that have prestige or letter writers that have the ability to speak basically to my abilities.
Right.
And where to strike a balance.
Okay, so the question was, what's the correct balance of letter writer choice? Prestige or proximity to your own work or deep knowledge of your own work? And I will be getting to this, but I'll also give you the answer now. And that is, if you have people who are prestigious, that know of your work, and you are pretty sure that they know enough to say positive things about it, you should definitely have them write a letter. You want to be the person that has that external perspective. You want to be able to establish you've made a bigger impact than just impressing the people in your own institution. And so if you have that, absolutely, right. Big thing. Any other questions? Okay, so your application letter and CV. This might seem straightforward, and if you've reached this stage, you're at Perimeter, you've probably written a few of these in your day. And apparently successfully so far. So one of the things I can tell you is the letter that you wrote for your postdoc is probably not the one you can use to get a faculty position. You can't just change the dates and the addresses. You're actually better off to write something specifically for this event and take the time to do it well. So tailor it for the institution, explain briefly what you know about them, how you're the perfect match for them, with examples. One of the things that I've found a lot of people do is they bury their lead. That's a newspaper editor saying, it's where you sort of wind, cranking up the car slowly, eventually it turns on. That's before my day even, actually. But the thing is that you need to hit people in the first sentence with something impressive about yourself and your match with the institution. Powerful first sentences with backup. Don't start, I was born in a 2,000 person community in rural Manitoba. You know, that's irrelevant. I want to come to your institution to take advantage of the fact that I've solved the Jacobian of blah, blah, blah. Say right up front what your strength is and how this is the most exciting thing you can possibly think of is to get this position at this institution, because it will work for everyone. So think Tempest, think, you know, big percussion. Right at the beginning, immediate good first impression, not something that builds and builds and builds through your entire letter until finally on the second page you get to the point of what you do and why you're good for the institution. I've seen that. Those people didn't get the job. Identify synergies. That's the example of med school. You have math, stats, you know, things that actually could be synergistic with other programs in the university. That's something you should mention. If you know enough about, it's certainly at McMaster, we have people that work together from all sorts of different programs to work on, say, origins, astrobiology, beginning of life issues. It doesn't need to be that you have to be in a single department. And as a rule, people will be more impressed with you if you don't have what we call silo thinking. I want to be in this department. I want to do this with this computer. You want to be full of possibilities and full of cross terms for the university, at least the potential for cross terms. Make sure when you're talking, you indicate that you know the landscape. If you don't know the landscape, find it out. You probably have people, friends who were hired recently or have a postdoc there. Probably your supervisor knows people. Actually go to the phone, write an email and say, I'd like to ask you about your program. You have half an hour. And learn about it before you actually go, before you even apply. That shows good initiative on your part. Don't sit there waiting for the questions or waiting for the next questions in interviews. When you come through for these interviews, you need to be on all the time. You don't want anyone to have to sort of have an awkward silence and then ask you a question. And go out there and say, I understand you work on balloon science. Do you do the following things, or what about that most recent result from the Planck satellite? Explain that you know their field to some degree, that you know enough to know about it, and ask them questions. Be proactive. Don't just sit there waiting to be interviewed. Those are the kind of people that universities tend to want. Here's a biggie. We are not fooled. You may have papers in preparation. I know I have about 10,000 of them. They count for nothing in the CV. So either get them submitted or talk about them in your talk as work underway, but don't have publications with 7 entries and only one of them being in a journal. That makes a negative impression, actually.
How about the submitted ones?
Submitted is okay. In fact, it's even better if you give more information, like when it was submitted, or what its current state is. Because you don't want the fear, uncertainty, and doubt creeping into their minds. Right? They want to know that you produce regularly. It may be the case that some crazy referee is holding things up. That does happen. But if you show that you submitted papers every 3 months to significant journals, that has a positive impression. And accepted is good too. And as you know, there are now weird states of journals where nothing ever gets printed. So, you know, it's fair game to go out of your way and explain how this publication is different from that one in that respect. So, it is, I don't know about your field in particular. I've been part of some very large teams in the research that I've done. So I'm part of the Macho Project, the Super Macho Project. And there are lots of authors on there. Don't have them ask what you did for that project. Be proactive and explain it in the first place. So explain the role, explain your value. That's just another opportunity for you to explain your value to them. And don't leave them thinking, oh, maybe the supervisor just had them added on, you know, as an extra favor as an author. So make it yours. Make the information transfer, put it in your power as much as possible. Take control of it. So here's the question. Here's the issue about reference letter writers. These probably are the most important components of your CV. It is almost always the case that your supervisor or your current supervisor will be one of them. If they aren't, it's probably best to explain why they're not. Again, so since you don't want the fear, uncertainty, and doubt to creep in. There is another unknown secret that you can actually get more than the requested number of letters. If you can get more good letters in your file, even if they only ask for three, you can get five. Because that just makes a better impression. There is another aspect of letter writing, which unfortunately is a very sad aspect, and that is you don't know what's going in those letters. And worse yet, in many instances, you don't know that they've been sent. You may be using a particular form for exchanging application materials. How many of you use math jobs, for instance? So you know about math jobs. So I believe in math jobs, you can actually see whether you can see that somebody has deposited a letter there, right? Or not. You can't actually see the letter, though. Right. So the old system is you wander up or you write an email to somebody and you say, would you write a letter for me for this position? And say, I need it on this time scale. Here's the job ad. Here's a copy of my CV. And they say yes. And then some non-zero fraction of the time, those letters don't get written. There is a special place in hell for those people. But that doesn't really help you out right now. So one of the things I would do is I would again take control of the situation by saying, I'd really like a letter from you. Would you be willing to write one? Do you mind if I ask you whether you've written it, if I haven't heard from you by such and such a date? Do you mind if I remind you or just check? And they'll almost always say yes. I personally tell people, I'll write this letter, but only on the condition that you check with me 1 week beforehand if you haven't got an email from me saying that I've sent it. So because the letters are so important, this is something you should not leave to chance. You should be able to check that it's been sent. There are people who are extremely familiar with your work. There may be lots of those locally. It will likely work better for you if you can get people from additional institutions and people of national and international prominence. If you know they're familiar with you and have a good opinion of your work, they're good people to ask. There's a bit of a trade there in that sometimes you get people who are so busy, they write very short letters. But sometimes they write really good letters. Frequently they write really good letters. So I can't tell you ahead of time who all the perfect people are, but you might ask your supervisor, because your supervisor might have heard rumors that, oh, this person, you know, this person doesn't send letters they claim they're going to send, or they send too short and too uninteresting letters. There's a lot of that knowledge out there, and it can help you. So, important one. There are these different systems. I'm really only familiar with math jobs, but I know others exist, where might say they're CV repositories. You put your CV in, then you tell the institution, you can go and get my CV and get my letters at this place and drag them out. There's some things you need to be careful about that. You need to make sure that it looks fresh. And I have seen math job CVs that are 2 years old when I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, why isn't this up to date? Or worse, is this up to date? I want to know that the information is up to date and that you're putting in absolutely everything in there that you can, and that once you start, you should be updating everything every year, and you should be asking these letter writers, if you've had an unsuccessful previous year, to update their letters to at least change the dates on the letters. Because otherwise it just communicates that you were uncompetitive last time. Okay, I mentioned closing the loop already. Any questions on this? One of the things about asking more letters, if you can manage it, is it does partially guard against the non-arrival of a letter.
Letters also should be written specifically for that job, or it can be something general.
Okay, so letters, the question is, should the letter be written for the job, or can it be general? The whole purpose, the whole reason things like math jobs exist is to really have generic letters from people. So, and I've read those letters, and they do have a different voice. They don't mention McMaster anywhere. As long as all the people are going through math jobs, that's not a difference that'll impact you. But it is possible to have some middle ground where if you informed the people writing your letters that your first priorities for institutions would be the following, they could write it in such a way saying, I believe this student would be ideally placed in a research-intensive graduate program like McMaster or so-and-so or so-and-so. You know, and they wouldn't have to say one particular one. But it would also communicate something that isn't just generic. So some of it depends, obviously, on your letter writers. And you can't put too many words in their mouth, but you can try the Jedi mind tricks. Any other questions? Okay, research statement. This is the one that you're probably most familiar with and probably have the best idea in my experiences. Most people write pretty good research statements. So here are some of the characteristics. Show you have a plan, show that you can grow, that is, show you have a different plan than just keeping doing what you've been doing so far, and that you see the opportunities in your field. Communicate that you understand the field. For instance, in astronomy, if I was working in some sort of high energy particle end of things, I might talk about the recent exciting experiments, the missions that are about to be launched, and how they will change the field, how that you are likely to have access to that data or even be a science member of the team. Show that you understand what's going on. Communicate that you have special talents that other people don't have. Again, playing up the differences between you and other candidates. This is no time to be Canadian. This is the time to promote yourself. One of the things that a junior faculty member typically doesn't have, or a candidate for, say, an assistant professor position, so they don't necessarily have any evidence that they can attract research funding. If you have been part of something that did get research funding, now's the time to trot it out. and say, I wrote the XX proposal for YY, the component of it, and which was funded at so many dollars per year. So again, show that you've done, you may not have been the PI on a grant before, you know about writing grant proposals. You've had your first taste of it, they were successful. It's important to convince people you know how long things take to do. Can't do everything in your first 2 months there. Or you have a set of realistic milestones. It's not too hard to make that. But even showing that you've thought of milestones is an advantage, in that it shows that you're planning. You should have, you understand that they understand that they're expecting progress at a reasonable rate when you get hired. You need power on all scales. When you're going to a university, you need some things you can achieve quickly. You need some things that you want to achieve that are perhaps more powerful on a longer term scale. So make sure you have a set of things that hit the ground running with, as well as the thing that's going to change the world that's going to take a little longer in your plan. There are non-financial resources in universities. This is something that a lot of people don't, that get interviewed, really have no concept of. There are places where you can bring in sets of undergraduates. You can take it. You can McMaster, for instance, has an ISCI program, which has a set of very talented, very high achieving students that are together in a cohort throughout their entire undergraduate career. And they're really primed to do research. If you have some idea of how you could make your research part of their senior or fourth year project, and all of a sudden have six additional people who are highly skilled working to put something together for everybody's benefit, that's good. They're going to like that because it benefits many different parts of the university simultaneously. So think about some of those things. In your research statement, do not write continuous text in small fonts over pages and pages. Use paragraphs. Use headings. Use white space. It is exhausting to read continuous text, and it really shows if somebody else isn't doing it, you will not come off as something that's not in your favor. Actually breaking things up, having a figure for every half page that is relevant, sort of illustrates the point of what you're trying to achieve. That's all good. The time you spend in terms of your preparing your research statement to be a better communication tool than other people's is time well spent. Any questions about the research statement?
How long should it be?
How long should it be? Good question. I would say that you should worry about it being I would say 4 pages. 4 pages, maybe 6 different ideas for research in those 4 pages. You need to be precise, but you also need enough prose to show you've thought it through, you know what the field's like. You can put some references in smaller font. But remember another thing, a lot of the people evaluating your letters have bad eyes, you know, and so really the small font thing is a really bad idea. Okay, teaching statement. I had the very interesting situation in the last 2 years where somebody came in to one of the programs, master, it's on the short list, and they had plagiarized their teaching statement. So first, don't plagiarize your teaching statement. They had a very, very brief interview. They arrived in their taxi and they left about 15 minutes late. So the thing about, yes.
How did you find out that they had plagiarized it?
Usually the voice is so different from the rest of the documents. It wasn't that hard to tell. So here, just be honest with yourself and just sort of be self-reflective. If you can, put this in the first person. Say how important good teachers have always been to you, and that if you've done TAing as a graduate student or even as a postdoc, you might recount some of the things that you learned from doing that TAing, things that worked, things that didn't, and that things were even saying that you'd like to improve on this area where you think you've done poorly, and understand that there's the Center for Leadership and Learning at McMaster, where I would be interested in taking course to make this particular aspect of my delivery better. You, if it sounds like it's coming from you, if it sounds like it's thoughtful, reasonable, it's probably a good teaching statement. For length, they tend to be one or two pages. If you have some sort of stats that showed you were the greatest teacher ever in a program, or you won some teaching awards, absolutely point that out at this point. And some, we do have TAs that win prizes. So if you got one of those prizes, mention it. Don't be shy. You probably have a philosophy about teaching, and now's the time to say it. Be as articulate as you can be. It's often a good idea to give both positive and negative examples of your relevant teaching experiences. And that will show that you have the ability to grow, that you maybe thought something that didn't end up being true. I would be wary of coming out and saying, everybody should be this way, because the students actually are a very, there are a lot of different people, a lot of different personalities, a lot of different situations out there, and it's very rare for one size fits all to work, especially in this era. So you might think about how you can adapt your teaching to situations where people, say, have part-time jobs, or they're taking care of their elderly grandparents or something like that. Having that kind of thoughtfulness about teaching will win you significant points when people are reading your teaching statement. This business about being open to independent assessment always shows that you're willing to try to do best practices and learn from your experiences. And this last bit was really that you understand the situation of real students in the here and now, and that you can work with them. When I first got hired, I was much more doctrinaire about, you're late a day, it's this penalty. And that's okay, you can do that, especially if you put it in the course outline. But there are other ways you can be. You can allow people to do 80% of the work so they get to choose when they don't do the work. You can decide that if everybody's having a hard time with the question, everybody gets 2 extra days to work on it. with a clue. So real students have a lot of pressures on them, and quite frankly, you and I don't understand all of them. It's very, very hard to get the measure of the full number of pressures and all the deadlines that people have on them in a given time. And so if you say that you recognize that, that'll probably work for you. Okay, any questions? So that's basically the application package. I'm going to get a swig of water here. Hopefully somebody will ask a question. How many are postdocs here? Raise your hand. How many are graduate students? Okay, I was interested in that mix. So some of what I'm saying about this package does in fact translate to becoming a postdoc. And I'm happy to try and answer questions about which parts do and which parts don't. I would say that if you're surrounded by postdocs who've been successful getting here, you should talk to them about what they think made their particular application successful. When I applied for a postdoc, I applied at an observatory that had ancient telescopes. In my cover letter, I said, I have no intention of using your telescopes. I intend to apply for Hubble Space Telescope time, use IRAF data, use the following ultraviolet satellite. And I'm convinced that that was the thing that made my letter different from everybody else, because everybody else probably said, well, I could also use your stupid little telescopes for the following thing. So you're shortlisted. That means you're getting invited to come to give a talk and be interviewed by really quite a large number of people in a short period of time. And it's pretty exhausting, but it's very exciting too. So if you haven't felt adrenaline before, you'll feel it during this. So the shortlist is generally created by the department. And as a rule, what it means is they like what they see on paper enough that they think that you could be hired if you're their top choice. Doesn't always end up being true, but that's sort of the level we're talking about. And 3 to 5 candidates are typically invited, usually invited over a reasonably short period of time, sometimes fairly easy to figure out who they are if you read departmental web pages and see who's being invited around you, which is intel you can use. They all go through essentially identical sets of interviews. This is really an employment fairness thing. The fix is not obviously in for anyone. And I am not aware of any job competition at McMaster where there was a clear fix in for, there was one person that they really, really wanted and they were just bringing in the other people to fill out the queue, basically. It's usually a real competition. So mostly you can trust that. The visit can be very nonlinear. While I was department chair, we had a competition where I was certain I could identify the person who was going to get it beforehand, and they didn't get it. In fact, they performed very poorly in person compared to the other candidates. It wasn't any single word they said. It was just they interviewed poorly compared to the other people. The interview can change things. I don't know, this is a number from a few years ago, I don't think it's changed very much, but when people hire a faculty member, they're usually a faculty member for 20 plus years. So it's a big, big commitment and investment on the part of the university, and they really want to be sure that they're getting the right person. And so you're going to talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people are going to express their opinions on you and the other candidates. before coming to a decision of who should be offered the job. So the visit usually have half hour long interviews with small groups of faculty members, with the chair, with the dean, with the provost or their assistant, with the associate dean of graduate studies, and you're just shuffling through these rapidly. It's a lot like speed dating. So, with respect to the department, obviously that's where you're mostly on home turf. You're more familiar with this sort of thing. But understand the whole department. Most departments have a couple of different specialties. Understand what they are. Understand the awards that have been made recently in the department by NSERC or CIHR or wherever, and how the things that are simmering and cooking in the department right now. There is a lot of publicly available information. Universities and departments love to issue press releases. They love to brag about themselves. There's also the case that when people get awards, there will frequently be an award citation explaining the whole history of a particular faculty member and their group and their successes. Read those things because they contain a lot of information. When you're in with each group of faculty members, ask insightful questions. Don't just sit there and let them ask you questions. Pop in and say, I heard about this new scanning electron microscope. What are you doing with that? Or, what are the things that it can do better than all the other scanning electron microscopes? So situational awareness. You will usually get an opportunity to have lunch or at least a meeting with postdocs and graduate students. They can be a good source of ground truth, less market-honed. And so you can usually extract some useful information about tensions or difficulties in the department or exciting things that from their perspective. So take advantage of that. Recognize time constraints. Don't go into full your set of the middle of the crescendo and have to be cut off because somebody arrives at the door to take you to another meeting. Make sure that if you have something you want to say to a particular person, you say it early enough in the interview that you get the whole point across. It is fairly common for departments to be behind in their schedule in a way that's impossible to actually catch up. So make sure you know the main things you want to communicate to each of the people you're going to meet. Try and make sure they get in there. Meals are a very good place to impress people because you have a lot more relaxed time, especially dinners. Usually they're long, leisurely, usually very tasty dinners with every applicant, and that's the place where you can tell the longer stories or really fill out your persona in their minds by talking more about the things you want to talk about and communicate that you have perspective. One of the great difficulties all universities and departments have is they have a finite amount of space, volume of space. Some people don't need more space. If you're one of these people that needs to have a lab, this is something you need to arrive with an idea of what you need and possibly even having talked to the chair beforehand to see whether there's indeed enough space to even make it a possibility for you to move there. Any questions? Okay, so outside the department, there are these people you meet, and all of them have agendas. If you can pluralize agenda. So they each have a specific responsibility. These may be slightly different from institution to institution, but this is a fairly common thing. So the dean, they're going to want to see that you're a reasonable person, but they also want to discuss salary with you, what your starting salary might be, and what your startup package might require. It's a good thing to not be from the other side of the universe on these things. So if you've got shortlisted, talk to some people who are junior faculty members. They'll usually be very, very happy to tell you what their package was and their starting salary. You can certainly learn this information easily enough. And then don't be crazy when it comes to talking to the dean. The associate dean graduate studies, that would be me. I want to know that you have what it takes to be a good graduate supervisor. I want to know that you can reasonably provide graduate courses in a range of areas. So make sure you communicate to me what your thoughts are on graduate students. Make sure you can communicate that I'm excited about the potential of having graduate students. I have a goal for how many I'd like to have. I'd like to start with 2 masters or 2 PhDs. One of the things I tell people is, with your startup package, you can actually use some of that money to hire international students rather than waiting for the rather spotty number of domestic students of just the right persuasion to actually come to join you in the program, because it's important to hit the ground running. So the provost or vice provost, they want to know more about the undergraduate side of things, what your perspective is there. So all these people will write something, either an email or a letter, to go back to the department, to all the people saying, I met with this person, I was impressed with this, I wasn't impressed with that. Their letters were pretty lackluster. I think this person was third in my opinion, behind so-and-so. And so the person who gets appointed, will have that set of letters like this that have come from all these different directions, the department, and all these people, in their file when it goes to the Senate Committee on Appointments to be filled. So you actually are being evaluated, and it's a written evaluation even, for when you meet these people. It's not just something you have to survive. You have to have some level of impressing them. And what's more, all of these people have been doing this a lot. So they're pretty good at knowing what to look for and when people are extra impressive. Okay, any questions about that?
You talked about the shortlist. Have you ever not hired anybody or hired several people?
Yes, that happens. Generally, the hired several people, you usually want to make that decision ahead of time so that it looks extra attractive to a pair of really outstanding people, rather than at first seeming that you're going to hire one but then hire two. I have seen the double hirings, but only in the first mode. Never hire. We sometimes go down the list when the first person has been picked off by another institution, but we will never pick two if we've only got approval for one. And these days, you only have approval for one. Any other questions? Okay. So part of the situational awareness is knowing how things have changed in the last 30 years. And Perimeter has been one of the reasons for such changes. Is there are what are called bridging appointments or joint appointments, which mean that the university only has to put up a fraction, usually half the salary, and the other institution will pick up the other half for a period of time, after which you will be considered for tenure and might belong to only the university at that point. That's fairly common. So knowing where that can happen is a good thing. There are a number of these. For instance, the Canadian Space Agency sometimes funds positions like this. AECL, I don't think it has that same name anymore, but Atomic Energy, they want some nuclear physics faculty appointments that will help support those in institutions in a bridging way. Yes?
Maybe it's too early to tell, but do you have any sense of whether or not that is or will lower the tenure rate of folks in those situations?
It won't lower the tenure rate, or at least it most, you know, some institutions may go strange directions, but in general, that won't have an effect, is my estimate. So research funding sources, sometimes this is very easy and clear, it's NSER. Sometimes if you have, if you're a statistician or you do something else, there might be additional foundations or even international sources for funding. If you know about those, trot them out. And because they're an extra reason why people might hire you is because you have these connections to these other things. Financial condition of the faculty. This is generally public knowledge. Usually can be found out without too much information. It really is a question of how much flexibility they can have when you decide to really hit the accelerator and try and push the limits on what you need later after you've first demonstrated yourself. There are graduate funding constraints. You may or may not know that in Ontario, universities only get money from the province if a student is within time and is Canadian citizen or a landed immigrant. They get $0 for every international student from the province. And that obviously should change, but it is something that tends to tilt the what kind of students get accepted, what fraction of them are domestic and what fraction of them are international. So if you come in and say, oh, I want 5 international students, well, that's great. Do you have a $100,000 grant to support them? Usually, if you're starting up, you won't have a $100,000 grant to support. Because there is this business of trying to hire local graduate or domestic landed immigrant graduate students. People are all fighting over the same pool of students. So one thing that you could do very well, if you can think of things, is ways to increase the attractiveness of the particular program that you're getting engaged with. If you have ideas, the fact that you've even thought of it will be a positive thing. And there are a number of things you can do, but if you have ideas, that's very good. If you have connections with foundations or industry, if you've had some sort of My Tax placement in the past, that again is something you should trot out, or you should trot out that you know about My Tax and the fact that you can get some support for some students under certain situations. And it's not just all I can do is apply to NSER and then wait out the next 5 years until my next NSER is up. So we want to see that you're aggressive and that you you know all the variables, you know all the degrees of freedom for your particular situation. If you have international connections, that's very good too. And you should communicate that. Okay, we're getting close to the end, don't worry. Just a little over an hour. Yeah, be mindful of the time. Anyway, so your job talk. You finally got in front of this crowd. You have 1 hour to make an impression, usually about 45 minutes of which you should count on having available to you. A lot of things can happen during the job talk. During one of my job talks, there was a person sitting in the front row going repeatedly. And, you know, I was kind of just sort of checking, do I have anything stuck to my heels? There was nothing wrong, except this was a homeless person, and it was warm inside, and they happened to sit in the front row of my job talk and giggle at me continuously. So that usually doesn't happen, but I'm just saying. So you're going to have a broad group of people listening to your job talk. And they're going to be outside your specialty. One of the things they're going to be looking for is that you can translate it. We already know that you've got papers in your subject. You already know you're pretty good with the tensor calculus. So make sure you include a big part on science driving things, the perspective of the field. Absolutely critical to have that stuff. Give lots of credit to the other people, the people that came before you, the people you've worked with. Everybody will assign that credit back to you if you're giving it to them. So it works out very well. Big fonts, no red on purple. I mean, one reason to do this, if not, you know, you're insane if you put red on purple, but we see it. One thing you may not realize is but 1/6 of people out there have some color deficiency, and they can't make out the difference in values so well. So it's a good idea to actually make sure everything's very contrasty and different and legible from large distances. Why would you limit yourself to only communicating to the first half of the lecture hall? Make sure everybody in the entire audience can read things. It may be your big contribution is some dense derivation. Maybe you need to show that. Ask yourself, do I really need to show large, dense derivations in your job talk? If you don't, don't. We know you're good with the LaTeX. You know? We know you've gotten this far. We'd be more impressed if you could tell us what it meant rather than show us that you can do the math correctly. Do not overload slides. Use visuals. You know, use some distracting material that that will cause people to remember things visually that you say. You'd be surprised how important this set of slides you'll put together for your job talk is. Test animations beforehand. Some of them will still fail. One thing you should do is be aware of how good a speaker you are in terms of volume. And if you can't put out a lot of volume, a lot of our lecture halls have a lot of background noise. They shouldn't. They're lecture halls. But they do. They have old fans, and they have rumble from the HVAC system. So say, can I get a microphone? Because I think I need a microphone to be able to communicate. That shows, once again, that you've taken control of the situation. You've made a silk purse out of the sow's ear in terms of you may have a weak voice. You know how to correct that. And you do it ahead of time, not when people say they can't hear you. And finally, you don't get the job. Even though you've listened to this particular talk. There are a lot of situations. You probably will have to get on more than one short list to get a job. But the good thing is, if you get on one, you're more likely to get on others. And that there is a lot of talk between institutions on, oh, did you hear so-and-so is on the short list? And that makes you more desirable for the other institutions. So if you're in the position of losing one of these things, think it over afterward. Figure out what you think were areas you can improve on, and just do it better next time. And there will be lots of random variation. There will be these things you can't count on, like homeless people giggling in the front row. They give you a good story. even if you didn't get the job. And just regroup and good luck. You've made it this far. That's a good indication that you're going to be successful. And just try your best. And thank you for listening.